You are tuned to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The following program is a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman.
Hi, this is Roy Shoman. Welcome once again to Salvation is from the Jews, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic faith, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the completion, the fulfillment, the full realization of all of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. If you've been listening to us in the past, you know that one of my favorite things to do on the show is to have on other grateful Jewish Catholics, Jewish entrants into the Catholic Church, to talk about both themes that are of interest to people who are interested in the relationship between Judaism and the Catholic faith, and also just to tell their stories about how they also found the full realization of Judaism in the Catholic Church. I have the great pleasure and privilege today to have on the air as my guest a fairly long-standing friend of mine. Before I had the privilege of meeting her, she was one of the kind of icons in the pantheon of Jewish Catholic celebrity that I had read about and whose books I had read and so forth. And then events transpired and I was able to meet her, and since then we've become friends. And now I have the pleasure of welcoming her on the show. Are you there, Rhonda?
Oh, yes, I am. I'm delighted to be here. And I love your books and I love your entire apostolate. And this is a whole new side of it, which I'm going to be able to participate in.
Okay. Well, now people know your name, at least Rhonda. The last name is Chervin. I'll give a little bit of an introduction, but Rhonda Chervin is a lot of things. She is a philosophy professor at a seminary. She entered the church while, she'll tell the story, I hope, but while she was a university student and since then has become a very fanatic and dedicated and lifelong, Catholic, working towards the salvation of souls, basically, which is all of our jobs, I guess. She's the authoress of a rather intimidating number of books. I'll let her give the count, but I have a feeling it's at least in the dozens, if not in the scores. She has a web...
65, Roy!
Okay, 65. So I only have 63 to go. And she has an active apostolate, which is reflected in her teaching, in her books, and also in her website, which I believe is probably rhondachervin.org. What's your website?
If you just Google Rhonda Chervin with no H in Rhonda, you'll get me, Rhonda Chervin. But we'll say all this at the end, too, because
okay.
Maybe you don't like me, so you don't need to know this information.
Okay. Well, I guess then, before I get in any more trouble, I'll just invite you to tell your story of how you ended up from, you know, starting out as a, you know, normal atheist Jewess to being a fanatic Catholic.
Oh, now, one thing is, only a Jew who became a Catholic would ever use the word fanatic in a positive way, Roy. So this is the sort of thing I love. Is, see, there are all kinds of ways in which Jews, even if we weren't brought up Jewish, as I wasn't, but if we come from a Jewish background, there are all sorts of aspects of what we have to give to the church and what the church has to give to us that are a little different. And, you know, this is the first time I've ever heard any Catholic describe being a Catholic as being a fanatic Catholic as being good, because I'm always accused of this. Just because I have normal Jewish zeal, I'm accused of being a fanatic, right?
Well, I mean, just looking at it from the outside, I can't imagine any saint, I'm not putting you in that category, don't worry, but I can't imagine any saint who doesn't qualify as being a fanatic Catholic, because in fact, if this is true, in other words, if we live for all eternity and our eternity for hundreds of millions of years and then some is entirely dependent on how we spend this short 80 or 100 years on earth, nothing else makes sense except to have our eyes on that eternity. And that's going to make you a fanatic. It's going to make you not care about the things between birth and death in the same way as other people.
Right.
So, if I can get past the introduction of you as a fanatic Catholic, how did you become an enthusiastic Catholic?
Oh, okay. Well, it's a very long and beautiful story, and I love to tell it because it reminds me of these incredible graces that God gave to me. And so when people ask me this question, I say, well, do you want the 5-minute spiel, the 10-minute spiel, or the half-hour story? But now I have even more scope to tell all the juicy details of this marvelous story. So I'm now 76, and I'm a dedicated widow. And my husband also is a Jew who became a Catholic, but I've been a widow 20 years. So I will start with saying that most people assume that someone with a Jewish background who becomes a Catholic knew something about Judaism, was brought up in Judaism. In fact, some Catholics who don't know too many Jews, let alone Jewish Catholics, many of them think that most Jews are either like Isaiah or like Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof. And this is not the case. You should always pray for the Jewish people, because the large majority of us, especially in the, well, maybe all worldwide, but especially in the United States, are not deep believers. In fact, are skeptics about everything. So Roy is an exception in this way, in some, you know, in many ways. But anyway, so I came from a background that is different from any other person I ever knew, except my twin sister. Namely, we were not only not religious Jews, we were total atheists who never talked about God any more than you like to talk about whether elves are real or not. How much time in a year do you talk about whether elves are real? But, you know, we never talked about God. I didn't even know the meaning of the word. Okay, because my parents were both from Jewish backgrounds, but atheists, atheist backgrounds themselves. And besides that, occasionally you'll meet someone, a Jew who is brought up in an atheistic household, though that's rare enough. But my parents met in the Communist Party and became ex-communist Joseph McCarthy informers on the Communist Party just about the time we were born. In fact, it's said that the communists said that because he was informing on them, this is New York City, that they were going to bomb our cradle. So who comes from such a background? So in the apartment house I was living in as a kid, there were Zionist Jews, there were Reform Jews, there were Orthodox Jews, and there were communist Jews, but no anti-communist Jewish atheist kids, see? So we were so alienated, as they say nowadays, you know? So in any case, I didn't even know I was Jewish, but I was going to a public school that was in this west side of Manhattan in New York City, and 99% of the kids in that school were Jewish. So the Jewish holidays come along. There were 5 kids there. One was a Protestant. One was a Catholic. Probably his parents weren't married in the church, so he was the only one who didn't go to a Catholic school. All Catholics went to Catholic school then. And the two of us, these little twin girls. So one day I said to my mother, you know, it's strange, there's only 4 kids in school today. And she said, oh, well, you are Jewish. You can take off. It was the first time I heard that. I knew that we were Jewish,
So this was a Jewish holiday when no one else was in school because they were all Jewish except the 4 of you or whatever.
Right. Yeah. So that's pretty unusual. But besides this, what people don't realize is that neighborhood is just like the musical West Side Story. It was a Irish Catholic neighborhood with Puerto Rican gangs coming in. Or coming and becoming gangs to protect themselves against the Irish gangs. So my association with Catholics was not in school, because the school was all Jewish. All the Catholics were in Catholic school. So all these Catholic hoodlums had rosaries dangling out of their pockets and crucifixes around their neck. So one time a little group of these hoodlums gathered around my twin sister and I, and they said, "Are you Jewish?" And we said, "No." This was before my mother told me I was Jewish. Said, "No." And he said, "Are you Protestant?" "No." "Are you Catholic?" "No." "So what are you?" So I said, "Atheist." They didn't know what it meant, so they let us go. So there I was. So I'm studying in school, and we come to, in junior high school, there's a little, write in class a composition, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" So this wasn't my mother speaking. This was just me because it was in class. So the teacher says, "What do you write a paper on what you want to be when you grow up?" And my first line of the paper, I was now like 12 years old, maybe, I said, "How can I know what I want to be if I don't know the meaning of life?" So I see this as the beginning of the Holy Spirit trying to show me that through philosophy someday I would find truth. In any case, so I go through school and I'm studying philosophy at the university, and these are not religious schools, so everything is totally skeptical. And I'm looking for truth. So the way philosophy is in such schools then, it's a little better now, actually, in certain ways, because they're a lot of the teachers know the truth, which is Marxism, according to them. So they're not as skeptical. So anyway, so I'm looking for truth, and I'm also looking, and I'm not finding it, because the way it worked was the teachers would teach you logic, so that you could use your mind as a knife to chop up anyone else's philosophy and throw it in the garbage can. So a little twit, a little college student could get rid of Plato in five sentences like that. Very arrogant. And so we never saw the mind as a light which could achieve wisdom. But we were searching for wisdom because this philosophy is love of wisdom. So I was also searching for love. Now, with the love part, my mother was part of Paris Cafe Society. She was friends with people like Hemingway and all these characters, these American expatriates in France and all this. So I was brought up with the idea that the most exciting thing in the world was to have love affairs with interesting people. And I never thought of marriage as something good because my parents weren't married. And then my father left when we were 8 years old and married a conventional Jewish woman who insisted he marry her. But I had no good feelings about marriage. And so I was trying to find love this way. So by the time I got to graduate school in philosophy, I couldn't find truth and I couldn't find love. And I decided I'm going to kill myself. Why do you live in order not to have anything, not truth or love? You just suffer. That's what life is. And so this is when many miracles began to happen to me. And the first miracle was connected to a TV program, and that's why I always do radio shows or TV shows when people ask me, because I don't listen to radio or watch TV all that much, but since the most important moment in my conversion, the start of it, was through a TV show called The Catholic Hour. And on this Catholic Hour were Dietrich and Alice von Hildebrand. And they were talking about goodness and truth and love and beauty. Now, how did I happen upon this program? This has to be a miracle, because it was an afternoon show at 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. My mother never watched TV in the afternoon. None of us did. We only watched I Love Lucy and Sid Caesar. That's the only programs we ever watched on TV. So why in the middle of the afternoon would she turn on the TV, come upon this show, and say, "Rhonda, come quickly, they're philosophers on the TV." So here I am, a philosophy student, looking for goodness, truth, beauty, and love, and thinking I could never find it. And here are these philosophers talking about it as if it exists. Love, truth, beauty, goodness. So I wrote them a letter to the TV station, and I said, I'm a philosopher and philosophy student, and I've been looking for truth and love, and I can't find it. Can you help me find it? Well, it turned out they lived very near me in New York City, and Alice invited me to visit her. And even though I knew nothing about the Catholic Church, after 1 hour with her, I said, this woman is a saint. And the reason why was because no one ever looked at me the way she looked at me. She looked at me with absolute attention and with a sense of meaning that I just never saw anyplace else. And I don't remember what we said, but then she said, maybe you would like to sit in on some classes at Fordham University, where Dietrich von Hildebrand was teaching. And maybe you'd like to switch to look at, to sit in on these classes and see if you like the classes. Maybe you'd like to study there instead of at Johns Hopkins, where I was studying. Now, at Johns Hopkins, the whole emphasis was on history of philosophy, and no one even bothered looking for truth. We just studied what other people said. But we didn't try to criticize them. We just studied them so we would know what they said. So I go to one of these classes, and who takes me up to the class is Stephen Schwartz, who you certainly know, who is a wonderful Catholic philosopher. And what I didn't understand those first classes that I sat in, I didn't really understand what they were saying. What I saw was that whereas we had been brought up, to my twin sister and I, to think that all religious people were stupid and weak, here were these strong, strong characters who were brilliant. And they could refute skepticism in one sentence and relativism in two sentences. So this impressed me. So I decided I would leave the school where I was at, where I couldn't find love, because the guys I was were interested in were married and happily married, so that didn't lead anywhere. So I couldn't find love there, and I certainly couldn't find truth. So I decided I would leave Johns Hopkins, and they got the Woodrow Wilson people to give me a scholarship there. I had a scholarship with Woodrow Wilson people. So I got my scholarship transferred to Fordham. And then, besides the fact that these people were brilliant and very strong and vital people, whereas the academics at the schools I studied at, not all of them, but many of them, I called them desiccated, sort of bloodless, passionless, whereas these people were filled with passionate love of truth, the teachers at Fordham. So I switched to there, and I'm taking these classes, and meanwhile, they're inundating me with love. Not romantic Cafe Paris society love, but the real thing. So they just took me in immediately into their circle, which is the whole von Hildebrand circle of philosophers. And these philosophers had come over during World War II. They had come over from Europe because they were anti-Nazi and they were being persecuted by the Nazis. So they had come to the United States. So in the summer, to get back to Europe, which they still loved, we're now at the year 1959. They would give Catholic art tours, and in the summer, so they'd take people, Catholics, to Europe. They go around to the beautiful churches and museums with pilgrimages, and then they, because they could get then free airfare to Europe, then they'd spend a month visiting their families afterwards who were still in Europe, and then come back again. So they asked me if I would like to go on this pilgrimage. So I said, well, I'm not interested in the Catholic Church, and I hate art, so why should I go? And I don't have the money. So I hated art because my father loved art, and when we were little kids, he used to schlep us to the museums, hours and hours in the museum when we wanted to play paper dolls. So I got this dislike of art. And this is very important because I had all these miracles that involved art, so they certainly weren't because I was some sort of aesthete. Anyhow, about the money part, they said, well, there's a scholarship we could get for you. Now, this was just concocted, as a matter of fact. It was given by Lyman Stebbins, who was one of the von Hildebrand set, who later became the founder of Catholics United for the Faith. And so he gave this scholarship because they all thought that if I saw the beauty of the Catholic Church in Europe, it would help me find the faith, which in fact it did. So I trotted off on this pilgrimage, and the minute I got to Paris, and I saw Notre Dame Cathedral, this cathedral was, the beauty of it was astounding to me, and had looked nothing like, in my mind, nothing like the church in America, which I had never been in a church, so I didn't have any feelings about the church in America. But the sublime beauty of this church just blew me away. And then when we got to Chartres, this was even more so, the beautiful church of Chartres. And I looked at it, and what came to mind is this famous line in a poem by Keats, beauty is truth, truth is beauty, that is all you need to know on earth. And I thought, how could something so false as religion, which is just a stupid bunch of superstitions, how could such a thing so false produce so much beauty? So then I started, in the meantime, this whole group of the pilgrims, they were all daily communicants. And they used to go to a 7 a.m. mass before the tour started each day. And I went with them because I had nothing else to do. And I couldn't understand a thing that was going on in the mass. This was the Latin mass. I didn't understand anything about it. So I started getting a little curious. So my godfather-to-be, the philosopher Baldwin Schwartz, who was running the pilgrimage, he asked me if I'd ever read the Bible. I said, never. So he said, he searched around the French bookstores for a New Testament in English. I mean, that wasn't so easy to find, but he's very persistent. So I read the New Testament for the first time. And very confusing to just open the New Testament and start reading it. And I got the feeling, well, Jesus is some sort of prophet. That's nice. But, you know, a prophet wasn't even a word in my vocabulary, basically. Our heroes, my heroine was Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. She was my female heroine. And my male hero was, I guess, Abraham Lincoln, but that's about it. I mean, I certainly didn't know anything about religious figures. So I'm riding in the bus, the tour bus, and I close my eyes to take a little nap. And I have this dream. Well, it's obvious to me now. It wasn't a dream. It was an interior vision. And I see Jesus and Mary, and they're sitting at a long table, and Mary is beckoning to me and saying to me, come sit with us. And she's saying this in Hebrew in the dream. Now, I didn't know a word of Hebrew, but I knew it was Jewish. It was related to my Jewishness, of course. So that amazed me. And then my godfather suggested, why don't you say a prayer? I said, well, how can I say a prayer? I don't believe in God. So he said, why don't you say the skeptic's prayer? The skeptic's prayer is, God, if there is a God, save my soul if I have a soul. So for the first time in my life, I knelt down. Now, see, this is a big deal for people who are brought up as atheists. Kneeling is the most despicable thing you can imagine. Kneeling is saying that you're not Nietzsche's Superman, that you're someone who needs to pray. So, but I was copying them from seeing people kneeling at Mass. So I knelt down and I said the skeptic's prayer. The next place we hit was Lourdes. And they were a little worried, my mentors were a little worried that I would find it strange that there were all these religious goods being sold at this great shrine, you know, that I would, well, I mean, I was used to Coney Island and 42nd Street in New York. This didn't bother me, this kind of thing. I mean, I had nothing to compare anything with, but I was just enormously impressed by all the people in the processions in the night with candles singing in all these languages. This was only, you know, less than 20 years after World War II. And the idea that there could be Germans and French and English all proceeding with candles, not bitterly at enmity with each other. You know, at my time, the big idealistic thing when I was in public school was the UN, the founding of the UN. This was going to save the whole world for peace forever. And what I experienced at Lourdes was the real UN, you know, how nation people in nations can be united even if they were in bitter warfare by their love of Christ and the church. So I was impressed by that. The next big impression was in museum in Florence. There's a painting of Da Vinci, and it's a painting of the the Nativity, and it was an unfinished painting, sepia colored, unfinished painting, very famous. You sometimes see it on Christmas cards, but certainly not striking because it's just an outline of Mary. And I looked at this and I suddenly realized that there was something called purity that I had lost without even knowing what it was. That's how it came to me. And then I started thinking about how my mentors, my philosophy professors, I had never told them about my sinful past as an atheist person having love affairs and all this. And that they would hate me if I told them that this was my background. Well, I told them about this thinking they'd send me home immediately. And instead, of course, they were thrilled. Now they had a Magdalene to convert instead of just an ordinary philosophy student. So they were filled with love, how lost I had been because I didn't have what? The faith, I guess. But it just came across to me how much they loved me. The next thing was going to Assisi and just loving the whole feeling of St. Francis and Assisi, and then getting to, that's followed me all my life. I've never been a third order Franciscan, but I love St. Francis and I love his simplicity of life, that whole theme very much. So then we get to Rome and we go to this museum, and here's this other art miracle, which couldn't possibly be just some beauty experience, because the thing wasn't beautiful even in any traditional sense of the word. So there's a tapestry of Raphael in the Vatican Museum, and it's very worn out. And it has Jesus in the boat when he's telling the disciples, throw in your nets for another catch. It's called the miraculous catch of fishes. And we're standing in front of this. And remember, I don't like museums. I'm a tag along. You know, I love these people who loved me. So I tagged along, but I didn't like paintings of any kind, no less old tapestries. So I look at the face of Jesus and it turns alive and he looks at me. And then the next day we're supposed to go to the Pope it at St. Peter's to the big, the Pope's talk to the people at St. Peter's. So I said, well, you know, I thought of the Pope as being some medieval accretion of some sort. Besides, I thought of the Popes as being all gaudy and covered with gold, exploited from the poor. See, even though my parents were ex-communists, they still believed what the communists thought about the church. So I said, well, I'm not going to go. I'm going to go shopping today. Why do I need to go? I'm not a Catholic. And Schwartz, my godfather-to-be, who was a very mild character and who had never commanded me to do anything, said, you're going to this. You have to go. So that impressed me, so I decided to go. So we get to the part where this is Pius XII. We get to the part where he comes off the throne and blesses the people who are in wheelchairs in the square. And you can't see anything. My godfather, who is about 5'7", lifts me up so that I could see the Pope's face. And he had the same face as Christ in the Raphael tapestry. I saw the same face. So this impressed me enormously, that there's something here that's amazing. Now, all these things, I mean, there's no way that could happen just by coincidence, right, Roy?
No, these are clearly miracles.
Yes. Yes. So, I mean, a Catholic could think that. A Catholic who had seen 50 pictures of Jesus and then saw a certain expression on Pius XII's face could possibly make this connection, you know, but not an atheist who had contempt for the whole thing. So after that, I was a philosopher, not a mystic. So after that, I decided, well, I wanted to find out more about this. So I read C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. I read Chesterton's Orthodoxy. I read Newman's Apologia. I read Augustine's Confessions. Those were the four books that impressed me the most. And so by the time I was, the tour was in the summer of 1958, and on January 4th, 1959, I was baptized as a Catholic. Now, meanwhile, what did the rest of my family think about all this? Well, the first one was my twin sister. So she was not a philosopher. She was a dancer, a modern dancer in New York. And she didn't know what to make of all this. And one night I'm sitting going through all this apologetics with her based on C.S. Lewis and all this. And she suddenly sees my soul. I don't know what she saw. She says she saw my soul come out of my eyes toward her. And so she didn't like apologetics books, but she started listening to Catholic music. She's very musical. And she was most affected by Verdi's Requiem. And she would listen to that and get this sense of the beauty of the faith through the music. And so within a couple of years, she became a Catholic. My mother, meantime, was horrified. I was very close to my mother after my father left. And she was an atheist who had led a very sinful life in Catholic terms. And here she has this daughter who's her favorite person in the world, who's immersed in this medieval garbage for some reason that she can't understand. However, the whole circle of people reached out to her to befriend her. And she was very unimpressed by the ideas, but she felt loved by them. And eventually she became a Catholic 10 years after I became a Catholic. And my father, who was not only an atheist, but helped write atheist tracts. He thought this was idiocy, but he couldn't understand how his two daughters and his wife, all of whom he thought was very smart, could have bought into this nonsense. And by the end of his life, I gave him a book. He thought that all the presidents of the United States were atheists because they weren't institutional Christians. He didn't realize that deists still believed in God. I mean, deism is, it's not theism. Deism is where you believe there's a God who's got everything going, but he's not that involved and you don't go to church. So a lot of these presidents were like that. Not all of them. Some of them were Christian believers. But anyway, Abraham Lincoln didn't like going to church at all. However, I read a biography of him, and I put post-its on every sentence where he referred to God. And Abraham Lincoln was my father's hero. And I just left it with him. So right before he died, he read these quotes from Lincoln. So I hope for the best for him. Anyhow, now this story has nothing to do, it wouldn't seem as this story has anything to do with Judaism, except that certainly I had these, even though I knew nothing about Judaism as a religion, I was culturally very Jewish. So it's culturally very Jewish to always be analyzing everything, like rabbis doing pill pull, to always being very philosophical about everything, to being very articulate, to always expressing your emotions. You know, see, this is something very hard to explain to Catholics. Most Catholics and most Christians, as a matter of fact, are brought up, now you should be good. You shouldn't say anything bad. You shouldn't say anything. You should never use the word hate. You should never yell at anyone. Well, we were brought up on, you know, writers like James Joyce, Tennessee Williams. But also, I mean, the whole thing was evil. We thought evil was fascinating. We didn't think of it as evil even. You know, so we always expressed everything we thought. I realized I was talking to someone about this who was wondering why I can't shut up. And, you know, why I say things, why I'm not afraid to say everything I feel, where everyone else would be very cautious and careful to put up a big facade. I just said the way I was brought, Jewish intellectuals, the way we were brought up, I never had a thought I didn't express ever about anything. I didn't know boundaries, shame, all this. Well, it's a terrible thing to live with as a Christian because we're supposed to say good things, not bad things. So, I mean, it's 55 years I've been struggling with being over-talkative. But the good side of that Jewish trait of expressing what you feel is, of course, as a teacher, being able to put into words everything you think clearly, hour by hour and book after book, that's a very helpful trait. No. So, in any case, so, however, what really put me in touch with my Jewish roots was my husband, and his story is very different. But I want to pause for a minute and let you get a word in edgewise, Roy, because maybe you have to, you have some reflections on this part of the story.
I know it's a beautiful story. And, you say that your experience in some sense has nothing directly to do, or it's hard to tie it directly into being, having been Jewish since you weren't Jewish in a religious sense. But it's certainly the fruit of extraordinary grace. Obviously, God went to extraordinary lengths to reel you in. And some of that was undoubtedly your passion for truth. It reminds me of the story of Edith Stein, you know, that basically, actually, it's also in the story of Alphonse Ratisbonne, that when Alphonse Ratisbonne's Catholic friend, Alphonse Ratisbonne is just making, you know, mockery of the Catholic religion. And his friend said, I'm sure that God will reveal the truth to you, even if he has to send an angel, because you're so dedicated to finding the truth. But there's also the fact that that extraordinary grace might be because you're Jewish and God seems to have a particular, go to particular lengths to reel us in. So these are just random thoughts, but no, I don't have to stop you at all. Just keep going.
Well, actually, Edith Stein is very relevant. I realized after I read her story, she was a friend of von Hildebrand's circle. Dietrich von Hildebrand and Edith Stein were fellow students of Husserl. They knew each other. So she died praying for the Jewish people, offering her sufferings in the concentration camp for the Jewish people. So surely if she was, here's a Jewish atheist philosophy of him. She was an atheist when she converted to Catholicism. She wasn't a Jewish believer by then. She was an atheist through philosophy. So here's this Jewish atheist girl, and she links him up to one of the people she knew to reach him.
That's an interesting point. So Dietrich von Hildebrand was kind of a bridge, in a personal sense, a bridge between Edith Stein and your conversion, since he knew, was instrumental in your conversion and personally knew Edith Stein.
Anyhow, so here I am in graduate school, Catholic graduate school, and I'm looking to get married, and I don't want any of these, you know, bad, you know, sinful, bad types that I knew before that I had love affairs with. So I'm looking for a holy Catholic young man. And holy Catholic young men, or any Catholic young man, they really had trouble understanding me because I wasn't exactly the type they were used to, even in university circles. So instead, God linked me up with a Jewish atheist playboy, divorced playboy. And I don't want to give that whole story, but he was 20 years older than me, and he was a friend of my mother's. And so I thought he was the devil coming to get me. So I thought, I'll bring him around to the von Hildebrands to meet, and the Schwartzes, Baldwin and Lainey Schwartz were my godparents. I'll bring him around to them, and they'll tell me, just get rid of this guy fast, he's the devil. Well, they fell in love with him immediately. They loved him. And they saw all the good points in him, and, you know, thought one day he'll be a Catholic too. But he was divorced. He had been married it wasn't Tijuana. It's one of these other places like Tijuana where Americans go for swift marriages. You may think of the place. Anyway, so, but he was divorced and they didn't have children. And so we began a case to see if we could get a dispensation from his previous marriage. Now, he came from an Orthodox Jewish background on the Lower East Side, exactly the kind you always read about if you read these books about Jewish kids on the Lower East Side. And my theory is the following. All these kids, their parents were from the other side, like the exact family of Fiddler on the Roof when they got to America would be their families. So these kids are going to public school, and then when all the other kids are playing stickball and having fun, they have to go to Hebrew school and sit for 2 hours in the afternoon learning everything in Hebrew with old rabbis who are spitting into the spittoon. And so they all rebelled, and almost all of them became atheists. And however, he had this nostalgia for religion, and when he was a kid, one day he walked out of the Jewish ghetto, which is exactly like you saw in Funny Girl, if you saw that musical. Okay, he walked out of the ghetto one day and he found the public library. and he started reading from A to Z. So between A and Z, he came upon J, Jesus. And he fell in love with the figure of Jesus, but he couldn't figure out how to relate to him because he was an atheist. So he came into my life through my mother when I was just when I just converted. And he thought in some way by osmosis he could get Jesus through me because I was a Jewish atheist. So to make that part of the story short, New York City turned us down for a dispensation, but you could appeal that to Rome. So we went to Rome, and it took us for a couple of years. I dropped my PhD program in philosophy, and I worked as a secretary in a Texas oil drilling company doing specs of all things, because we thought very soon we'd get this dispensation from Rome. So we were living chastely and waiting to see if we would get this dispensation. And they were hoping that my husband would become Catholic, because since he was a Jew, if he became Catholic, there's the Pauline privileges, which is based on St. Paul saying that if a Jew wanted to be a Christian and marry a Christian, then he could be dispensed from a previous marriage if that partner didn't want to be Christian. So anyway, they were hoping to use this privilege to get his first marriage dispensed. But he was taking instructions, but he wasn't going anywhere with the instructions, because he loved everything about the Catholic Church. Particularly, he loved the whole mysterious, mystical side of the church, which seemed to him like Orthodox Judaism. So that's what he loved. He loved the Latin Mass, and he loved music. So he particularly loved the music of Gustav Mahler, who was a Jewish convert. He loved the soaring sense of the soul moving toward eternity, and all of this he loved. But he didn't believe in God. So how can you become a Catholic if you don't believe in God? So this canon lawyer from some other place besides Rome said, listen, you're never going to get this, Rhonda. You might as well just give up. So then I had to decide between all earthly happiness, which I saw as being married to Martin, or the church. And I got the grace to say, I choose the church. And then right after that, we got the dispensation and got married in the church. However, he didn't immediately become a Catholic, because it's just the time of Vatican II. And the whole thing of guitar masses and this friendly communal horizontal atmosphere, he hated. He loved the old traditional ways. And see, the Hebrew is a sacred tongue. Latin is a sacred tongue. He understood that. But everything that happened afterwards, and besides which, he was still an atheist. So, anyhow, but he agreed to have the children brought up Catholic, and he wished he had the faith. And he finally came into the church years afterwards, because he was very sick. He had been a 3-pack-a-day cigarette smoker. He got late-onset asthma. He thought he was going to die every night. So finally, the desire for eternal life won over the guitars. I love the guitar mass, by the way, but he hated it. So it won over all those changes, and he decided he should just make a leap of faith and become a Catholic, even though he didn't like the liturgy, which he did when he was 60. So that's that part of the story. So you could read his story and my story. One of them is in a book I edited called The Engrafting, but it's also in Roy Shoman's anthology of Jewish convert stories called...
Honey from the Rock.
Honey from the Rock. And then my book, the first one is called The Engrafting, and then I had another one with my husband's story in it called Bread from Heaven. So you can get those from the Association of Hebrew Catholics if you're interested.
Well, actually, since we are coming to the end of this hour, and I know that you've already agreed to come on again and talk about at least some of your books, do you want to briefly mention, some of your work, some of your books, the work on anger management maybe, or, you know,
okay,
just...
Okay, I lost track of the time. How much time do I have?
I would say we have about 4 minutes left, perhaps.
Oh, 4 minutes left. Okay, if you go to my website, www.rhondachervin.com, and that's Rhonda with no H, and Chervin is C-H-E-R-V for Victor I-N. You could see all these many books I've written, and many of them are out of print by now and are free ebooks. So you can read them or listen to audios of me for free. You don't have to even pay any money to get these books. So let's see. Most of my books, I've written about 6 philosophy books, which I teach philosophy. I've been teaching philosophy all my life. So most of them are about lay spirituality and particularly obstacles to holiness. Like we all want to be holy, but we're in denial of the obstacles. And one of the biggest obstacles is anger, hot anger and cold anger. And I have a book called Taming the Lion Within, 5 Steps from Anger to Peace. That's not free. That you have to buy. You can buy it from Jeanette Benkovich's little press, Simon Peter Press, if you're familiar with EWTN. But it's all on the website. But the latest one that I'm pushing the most is an anthology of 4 little books I've written on love. And basically, think of it this way. Holiness is having nothing but love in your heart. Joyful love, compassionate love, suffering love. What we don't want to have in our hearts is anger, resentment, boredom, disgust, anxiety. All those negative emotions shouldn't be in our hearts. So how are we going to deal with them? So this is a very practical book which starts out with all sorts of definitions of love, but then goes into obstacles to love. And daily exercises that you could do, like if you spend a whole week being grateful and not complaining once, you'd have the most beautiful week in your whole life. But it's very, so it has my experiences in them mixed in with scripture and meditations for the reader to do. To write down their own experiences of gratitude and that kind of thing. But besides beautiful chapters like the ones on gratitude, there are ones on forgiveness and there are ones on anger and there are ones on being bossy and there are ones on talking too much.
Well, maybe that's a good place to interrupt because we really are at the end. I very much look forward to having you on again and, talking more at length in particular about some of what you just said. Sort of, it sounds like practical, in some sense, practical guides to holiness, to growing in holiness, which is, of course, what everything's all about. So let me just close. You've been listening to Salvation is from the Jews on Radio Maria, a show on Radio Maria that's dedicated to the Jewish Catholic connection. We've been listening to Rhonda Chervin as our guest today, who's given her very beautiful witness testimony of how a not-so-nice Jewish girl ended up in the Catholic Church. And if you want to listen to this show again or any of our past shows, they're archived on the Radio Maria website, radiomaria.us, and also on my website, salvationisfromthejews, all one word, .com. And with that, I just hope that you join us again next week, same time, for Salvation is from the Jews on Radio Maria. Bye for now.
You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The program you just heard was a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman.